loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. In our first hour, we take a look at two stories. First, the U.S. reimposed massive sanctions on Iran today. 8 countries were exempted, including Iran's primary oil purchasers. Medicine and food were not exempted and will cause real humanitarian problems in the nation. We're going to take a look, an in-depth look at the politics behind these new sanctions. And then it's Friday, and that means it's our weekly half-hour segment called Technology Rules with Chris Garafa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedoms, civil rights, and civil liberties.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including 5 that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, tomorrow is Election Day as tens of millions of people prepare to go to the polls to vote in a variety of federal, state, and local elections. But if there's a change of party control in either the House or the Senate, will the politics of this country really shift? Next, in an interview yesterday, Donald Trump shrugged off U.S. responsibility for the horrific airstrike on a school bus in Yemen that killed 51, including 40 children, saying, quote, "That was basically people that didn't know how to use the weapon." But what is the real role of the United States in this deadly war? Then, if the Democrats win tomorrow, who will the Republicans blame? And if the Republicans win, who will the Democrats blame? From Russian interference to Chinese interference to much maligned but extremely rare voter fraud, the two major U.S. political parties have a number of scapegoats at the ready to avoid blame. And then, just days before the midterm election, Donald Trump amped up his anti-immigrant rhetoric and announced that he would send up to 15,000 U.S. soldiers to the U.S.-Mexico border. As rank-and-file soldiers are yet again used as political pawns, U.S. military veterans are calling on their fellow service members to refuse the order to deploy. And finally, today we continue our segment, Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? And in other headlines, Senator Mark Warner, Vice Chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, called for a further clampdown on social media yesterday. Warner cited allegations of Russian interference. Since the 2016 election, social media giants like Facebook and Twitter have used the Russian interference narrative to delete hundreds of alternative news accounts. Saudi Arabia faced intense criticism at the United Nations Human Rights Council today. The council was conducting its universal periodic review, something that all countries are subject to once every 4 years, of the human rights record of the Saudi government. Criticism focused on the Saudi government's role in the war on Yemen and the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The Supreme Court today decided against the Trump administration request to overrule the 2016 lower court decision that affirmed net neutrality regulations. This means that legal grounds remain for supporting net neutrality, though this Supreme Court decision has no bearing on the Trump administration's repeal of the policy. Toward the end of early voting in the United States, the Miami Herald reported 3-hour-long lines to vote in Miami-Dade County, affecting mainly black voters. The polling location didn't have enough ballots for the people who showed up to the polls. Through Saturday, voters cast about 504,000 ballots in person and through the mail. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to U.S.-Iran relations. The United States, under the Trump administration, reimposed sanctions on Iranian oil today that had been lifted under the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. The sanctions have already caused serious inflation, and there are fears that products like medicine and food could become scarce. 8 countries have been temporarily exempted from the sanctions, so their major oil purchases from Iran can continue. But the U.S. regime change push continues at full speed. We're joined from London by Shabir Razvi. He is an economist and political analyst. Shabir, welcome back to Loud and Clear. Shabir, yesterday was November 4th. It's the anniversary. Wow, time really flies. The 39th anniversary of the seizure of the U.S. embassy in Tehran following the Iranian Revolution that toppled the Shah, the U.S. proxy that had ruled Iran since 1953 when the U.S. CIA and British intelligence carried out a coup d'etat to overthrow the democratically elected government. There were protests in Iran on this anniversary, but the protests this time were against the economic sanctions, and American media showing Iranians in the streets burning American flags and Israeli flags. Obviously, the Iranian people, regardless of whether they support or oppose the current government, support or oppose the Islamic Republic, there's a lot of anger probably across the board right now. What do you think?
Well, insofar as sanctions are concerned, the history of sanctions on any government suggests a different outcome generally, because they often provoke nationalist outrage among the population directed, not really so much at the elite that is running that particular country inside, but at those in far distant countries who so cruelly impose these sanctions on a particular nation. So with that preamble, it's quite clear that the Iranian public, the masses on the streets have come out in support of the government of Iran, irrespective of whatever the political differences they may have internally, because it really ignites and inspires the ordinary people, because they realize that the sanctions are being imposed on them, not particularly just at the government, but the reality is that the ordinary people quite often get the brunt of these sanctions, but they realize that it's not their government who is to blame, but really the country that is imposing those sanctions. Hence, you've seen the demonstrations that you referred to earlier.
Shamir, I'm looking at the Wall Street Journal. It's from right now. The headline is, Iran's president says America will regret sanctions, and Iranian president promises to break new U.S. sanctions. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani vowed that his country would resist tough new U.S. sanctions on Iran's oil and banks on Monday as Tehran braced for a new era of political and economic isolation. Quote, unfair sanctions are against the law, UN resolutions, and international accords. Therefore, we will proudly break the sanctions, Mr. Rouhani said on national television after the sanctions took effect at the stroke of midnight in Washington or 8:30 a.m. in Tehran. What does he mean?
Well, clearly what Mr. Rouhani was referring to, and he had a meeting with the Ministry of Economic and Finance Affairs, and there he clearly outlined what you have just related. And what is really happening is that, and in your opening comments, you said that eight countries are already exempt from the sanctions, i.e. India, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, and even Italy in the European Union is exempt from buying oil from Iran. Plus, on top of that, there is sort of a window which has been left open that even American companies who may want to trade with Iran would have to get a special permission. So I don't think these sanctions are going to work. What you have to also relate it in the historic perspective, since the advent of the Islamic Revolution in Iran in 1979, almost 39 years ago, that sanctions have been applied continuously, and they have been of different types. The eight-year war that was imposed on Iran with the help of Saddam Hussein, and at that time, Iran was really just beginning with its revolutionary movement internally, and it was a lot weaker at that time. Over the last 40 years, Iran has become a lot stronger. It has industries which are quite sustainable, and plus the global alliances have changed significantly. At that time, Iran was very much isolated, except Syria, which was supporting Iran in the Arab nations, Russia, and all other nations were abiding by Washington diktat. Therefore, the situation with Iranian politics, with Iran's relationship with other nations is lot better. And I think the other nations are also unwilling to abide by these sanctions, because sanctions are being imposed, as you're well aware, on both Russia for different matters, all kinds of other economic situations developing between China and America is not really conducive for China to play ball with Washington at this time.
Shabir, let me jump in. That's the voice of Shabir Razvi. Shabir is talking to us from London. We're also joined now by Medea Benjamin. Medea, welcome to Loud and Clear.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Brian.
Thank you. Are you here in Washington?
I am. We just came back from a rally at the Treasury Department we did to oppose these new sanctions.
Okay, great. Medea Benjamin is an author. She's also an activist, one of the organizers and founders of Code Pink, the peace organization. And Medea has done considerable work about Iran, trying to improve U.S.-Iranian relations and, of course, opposing economic sanctions and military threats that are leveled pretty regularly against Iran. Medea, when I was talking to Shabir Razvi in the beginning, I was making mention of the fact that yesterday was the anniversary, November 4th, of the 1979 seizure of the U.S. embassy in Tehran following the Iranian Revolution. And the people in Iran were out in the streets and they were burning American flags and Israeli flags. And I was making the point that regardless of whether people in Iran support or don't support the government, traditionally, right now, they're pretty much angry at the United States and its allies in the region because Iran did everything it was supposed to do in accordance with the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. They did their part, and now the Trump administration is unilaterally imposing these sanctions that are designed to, well, of course, they're designed to hurt the government, but they actually just hurt people. Go ahead.
Well, that's right. I think this is the height of bullying. We should get Trump's wife, Melania, on this campaign, because this is Trump saying to the world community that I, Donald Trump, will dictate who you can do business with and on what terms. And to see the U.S. going around the world to strong arm small countries and large companies, big businesses, and to dictate to them, all right, you know, even when we give you a waiver around the purchasing of Iranian oil, it has to be on these terms that it will only be for 6 months, that you must reduce your the amount that you import, that you have to put the money into an account that can only be used for X, Y, and Z. It's just the height of imperial hubris, and I can't believe that Trump is getting away with this.
Yeah, well, Medea, a quick follow-up question. There's not a chorus of opposition within the Democratic Party leadership denouncing Trump for this, even though the JCPOA was perhaps, along with the reintroduction of normalized relations with Cuba and maybe the Paris Climate Treaty, that one of the signature achievements of the Obama administration. I don't hear many dissident, angry voices from the Democrats denouncing Trump over this.
That's for sure. And until very recently, anything to do with Iran was something that politicians would stay away from because it would sound like they were against Israel and Saudi Arabia. Now, on the Saudi front, they are more willing to denounce or at least not be totally rallying for Saudi Arabia, but there's still the pressure of Israel. And so you get politicians on both sides that really don't want to come out and oppose Trump on this. And I think it's just awful. I think the message that it sends to the entire world community is here's another example of the U.S. violating international agreements. And you talked about how the Iranians are blaming this on America. Well, and of course they should. And we've been in touch with a lot of people in Iran, and they tell us how this is really seen as directly coming from the United States and whether or not they like their own government, they feel that this is a unifying factor. So it really is not going to accomplish what the Trump administration wants it to do, which is ultimately get people out in the streets to overthrow their government. What it's going to make people do is spend more hours of the day trying to figure out where their next meal is coming from and figure out where they can find medicines when, while humanitarian products are supposed to be exempt, they're really not because the banks don't want to touch anything that has to do with Iran.
That's the voice of Madea Benjamin. Madea is an anti-war activist who is the co-founder of Code Pink. She's the author of Inside Iran, The Real History and Politics of the Islamic Republic of Iran. We're also joined from London by Shabir Razvi. He is an economist and political analyst. Shabir, back to you. Again, I want to talk about the Democrats in Washington, because President Obama put a lot of political capital on in to do something with Iran, normalize or start to normalize relations. There could have been, if it had proceeded, perhaps a thaw between the U.S. and Iran on a lot of different fronts related to the Middle East. This was the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, whereby Iran agreed to allow very intrusive inspections and severe limitations on its own civilian nuclear energy program so that it could not over time evolve into a nuclear weapons program, which Iran said it didn't want anyway. So I'm thinking back to when Obama first became president in 2009. There was an election. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was reelected president for the second time. There was a big movement that developed in opposition to Ahmadinejad. It was called the Green Movement. There were lots of street protests. Maybe it was sort of anchored in the northern suburbs of Tehran, more of the middle class area. But nonetheless, Hillary Clinton, who was then Secretary of State, told Twitter, which was scheduled to carry out a closure for a maintenance break for a couple of days, not to stop because Twitter was being used by the Green Party opposition forces as a way to, you know, tell people where to go and to demonstrate and to mobilize. In other words, the U.S. government at that time really decided for and wanted to support the Green Movement because they were hoping it would carry out like a regime change in Iran. Then that movement sort of died down or was repressed or a combination of those things. Now we have a situation where President Trump is trying to inflict a lot of pain on Iran, I think with the same goal, which is to have people hurt so much, as Kissinger said about Allende's economy when the U.S. imposed sanctions, make the economy scream, that the people will come out into the streets to protest and maybe to overthrow the government. But again, why would they possibly do that under these circumstances? It seems to be, in a way, it has no rhyme or reason in terms of what the actual practical goal is of the strategy. Unless you see something else.
Well, I agree with you. The reality is that the Trump regime, the Washington administration, is now really very much in the hands of the neocons, where you have Mr. Bolton, Mr. Pompeo, and also your Minister of Defense. They're all sort of working towards what is has always been the end game strategy in Washington is for a regime change. And you're absolutely right that they want to tighten the screw as much as possible so that the people start feeling the pain, and then hopefully they will come out on the streets instead of America really having any kind of intervention militarily, which I suspect Iran, the USA would never dare to attack Iran directly. And they're hoping that these demonstrations will bring about a change in regime in Tehran. But that is highly unlikely because with the current demonstrations, which you just alluded to, which took place in Tehran, it is very clear that the ordinary people, the masses, are very much in support of the government in Tehran, and they can see very clearly that Washington is trying to play this particular game of regime change by some other means, by using the weapon of sanctions. However, what you've got to also understand is that as far as Iranian economy internally is concerned, Iran produces most of its requirements, i.e. consumer products, are domestically produced. Yes, the pharmaceutical area is a bit of a challenge because of the rial becoming significantly weaker over the last 6 months. It's obviously going to cost a lot more money to import medical products. But as far as food is concerned, other consumer products that are required by the ordinary people, as you sort of interestingly pointed out, that those who live in the leafy suburb of North Tehran may not be able to get their Lamborghinis and the Gucci watches cheaper. Therefore, they may protest a little bit. But if you look at other cities, whether it is in Qom or Shiraz or Isfahan or Tabriz or many of the other cities, I think there is a groundswell of support for the government and the way that they are trying to manage and negotiate their way out of these sanctions, because there are a lot of countries that are not supporting this sanction regime, which has been applied by Washington in the last 24 hours.
Okay, that was the voice of Shabir Razvi. We're also joined by Medea Benjamin here in Washington, D.C. She was just at a demonstration protesting the new economic sanctions. Now we're joined by Professor Mohammed Mirandi. He teaches at Tehran University. Mohammed, we were trying to find you and so happy that you could join us finally. How are you?
Thank you for having me. Yes, I'm good.
Great, great. Again, we were just framing the discussion that yesterday on the anniversary of the seizure of the U.S. Embassy in Tehran in 1979, that was November 4th, there were new protests in Iran, people burning American and Israeli flags to show extreme anger and displeasure with these new sanctions by the U.S. supported by its allies in the region. You're there in Iran. What's the mood?
Well, actually, that's an interesting point that you raise, because what the United States has done, basically, is that they've created a link between a younger generation that does not remember the revolution, that could have had a more favorable view towards the United States because they did not experience the U.S. support for the Shah. The fact that the U.S. gave the Shah, who killed so many Iranians, refuge. They did not experience the war where the United States gave Saddam Hussein chemical weapons and aided him in using it, the United States and its European allies. So there was an opportunity for my university students and those who are in high school to experience a different relationship or cultural relationship or different understanding of the United States. And what basically happens is that the United States, governed by maximizing these sanctions on the anniversary of the embassy takeover, which, as I said earlier, was as a result of U.S. policy in Iran, the embassy trying to overthrow the government, the U.S. giving refuge to the Shah, they created a link between that past and the present. And I think the United States has destroyed its image in the eyes of a younger generation, that if they had played their cards well, they could have had a different, these people could have had a different worldview when it comes to the United States. So U.S. soft power, I think, has been utterly destroyed. And Iranians have an immense dislike for the U.S. government, and I think, unfortunately, even towards the United States itself to a degree because of this. And this helps the government, because the government, the more the country is unified, the better the government can manage. And when the president of the United States takes pride in brutality, and he speaks of brutal sanctions in Pompeo, they take and you see pundits on TV or even their Persian language TV outlets, Iranians, see them take pleasure in the hope that people will suffer, people find it very disgusting. So I don't see this as a win for the United States. I see this as an enormous failure.
Yeah, that's the voice of Mohamed Mirandi. Mohamed is an expert on American studies and post-colonial literature. He teaches at the University of Tehran. We're also joined by Shabir Razvi. He's an economist and political analyst. And we're joined from Washington by Medea Benjamin. Medea is an anti-war activist, the co-founder of Code Pink. She's the author of Inside Iran, The Real History and Politics of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Wise words from Mohamed Mirandi, Medea. Again, the U.S. succeeds at imposing suffering on people, but from a political point of view, from a point of view of its political objectives, it's not going to succeed. It just succeeds in showing that it's brutal, that it's cruel, that it's willing to use food and medicine as a weapon. But when you do this to people over and over and over again, at a certain point, people invariably resist and they'll think, like, wait, this isn't for what it says it is. It's not the stated purpose. It's not because Iran is on the verge of taking over all other countries in the Middle East or producing a nuclear weapon. It's really because the U.S. government has this other unstated but very real foreign policy objective, and they actually don't give a hoot about people. We have 2 minutes left. Go ahead.
Well, I think it's very interesting how Mohamed just talked about creating a link with the younger generation. The Trump administration's policy is supposed to be that we will make the Iranians see how terrible their own government is. And it comes out just the opposite. We will make the Iranian people see how terrible the United States is. And I hope that we as Americans can really strengthen our people-to-people ties and push our government on this issue. I think with the new Congress, and hopefully we will have a new Congress, we should be pushing for the U.S. to go back into the Iran nuclear deal and send a very strong message to the Trump administration that this policy is not in our name.
Very interesting. 1 minute left. Shabir, will give you the last word. If Trump is no longer president, either because he doesn't win in 2020, or didn't run again, whatever, if a Democrat who says they're for Barack Obama's legacy came back in, do you think the U.S. would actually go back into the JCPOA? 1 minute left. Go ahead. You get the last word.
Well, certainly, so long as Mr. Trump is in power and the Washington regime is taking the line from the neocons, it's highly unlikely. Washington's dilemma at this moment is that it is supporting the Saudi regime, which is really a rogue state, and to use Mr. Bolton's phrase, the troika of terrorism is really Washington, Tel Aviv, and Riyadh at this moment. And for that particular reason, and the dilemma that I talked about that Washington is facing at this moment, is that the world is seeing, the world community very clearly is seeing that Washington is not really interested in supporting the ordinary people. They want to inflict pain, as my other two guests have commented. And for that particular reason, I think there is no win for Washington in this particular sanction, and Tehran will in all probability come out stronger because it has survived the last 40 years of sanctions which have been applied continuously in one form or another.
That's the voice of Shabir Razvi. Shabir is an economist, political analyst. We were joined from Washington by Medea Benjamin, anti-war activist, co-founder of Code Pink, author of Inside Iran, The Real History and Politics of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And we were joined from Tehran by Mohamed Mirandi. Professor Mirandi is an expert on American studies and post-colonial literature. He teaches at the University of Tehran. We have a lot more coming. Stay with us.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. It's Monday, and that means it's our weekly half-hour segment called Technology Rules with Chris Garaffa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedom, civil rights, and civil liberties. We are joined from New Haven, Connecticut, by web developer and technologist Chris Garaffa. Chris, welcome back.
Brian, good to be back.
You know, Chris, it's almost impossible to talk about any particular story today without, you know, also noting that the election is tomorrow. Very much paid attention to election for a midterm election. I'm looking at a headline, Georgia GOP Secretary of State accuses state Democrats of trying to hack registration. Of course, there's a lot more to this story in Georgia because of the role of the same official in terms of overseeing the elections while having a very direct vested interest in the outcome. But let's start. Go ahead.
That's right. It's Georgia Secretary of State Brian Kemp also happens to be running for governor. You know, seems like a contradiction or a you know, a conflict here that he's, you know, overseeing these elections. Now, over the weekend, his campaign and he, as Secretary of State, actually says he opened a case against the Georgia Democrats for trying to hack the election systems in Georgia. Now, this, if you look at the, what the Democratic Party of Georgia has put out, including releasing some emails that led up to this claim, you actually see that it's not the case that the Democrats tried to hack the election systems. An unaffiliated person named Richard Wright on Saturday sent the Georgia Democrats an email saying that there was an issue with the online voting registration system. So you can go into this website in Georgia and you can look at sample ballots and poll cards, but there was a security issue with it. And what Richard Wright says is it allows you to download any file on the system. The second issue is then with the voter registration. You can just change a number on the website you're on, and you can download stuff like what he points out is personally identifying information like driver's licenses and the last four digits of a voter's social security number. That was then that email was then forwarded a couple times and then made its way to the Secretary of State's office and is being interpreted as the Democrats hacking the Georgia election systems, when in fact it was a third party, somebody who lives apparently in Georgia, saying that he found these flaws in the system itself.
Let's talk about what Brian Kemp himself. Now, he's Secretary of State, meaning overseeing the election. He's also running for governor against Stacey Abrams. There's been a lot there in Georgia about his own efforts or their efforts to suppress the vote. Talk about that.
Right. So many, many voters were removed from voter registration lists. There's actually a long history in Georgia of shutting down polling places in predominantly black areas. And, you know, Kemp has really just been running a very dirty campaign against Stacey Abrams, his opponent. You know, a lot of dog whistles, a lot of just outright racism in this campaign. So this is just the last, you know, probably his last big attempt, because it looks like Stacey Abrams, from what I saw this morning, is leading in the polls by a few points. And I feel like this might backfire on him.
Yeah. And Chris Garofa is our guest. We're talking about technology, although right now it's intersecting, of course, with the midterm elections that take place tomorrow. We have the 1965 Voting Rights Act for places like Georgia and other Deep South states, but not them alone, where black people had been consistently deprived of the right to vote, including losing their lives trying to have the right to vote. I mean, that's the long, sordid, disgusting history since America became an official apartheid state, which happened in the mid-1890s as a consequence of the Supreme Court decision, Plessy versus Ferguson. But I'm looking at also, I don't want to spend much more time on this, Chris, because we have other technology issues, but a group of black seniors in Georgia were ordered off a bus that was taking them to vote in early election voting. Do you know about this story?
I did hear about this story, and it's just another issue in Georgia. And Georgia is just one of many states that is trying to suppress particularly the black vote, especially in this midterm election.
I'm looking at Vox News. We're going to spend one more second on this. This is from 2 weeks ago. As early voting began Monday in Georgia, a group of black senior citizens gathered for a voter outreach event at Jefferson County's Leisure Center. Members of the Black Voters Matter, one of the groups behind the event, offered to drive the group of about 40 seniors to the poll. But shortly after the seniors boarded the organization's bus, county officials stopped the trip, prompting new accusations of voter suppression in a state already dealing with several such controversies. Chris Garofa, we have so many other stories, though, and some of them also pertain to the election. Let's keep moving. I'm looking at this story about the Texas voting machine software. What's that?
Yeah, so this is another issue with elections and with technology. Now, they use something called the Hart eSlate machines. They're third-party voting machines. And people in Texas started posting in Twitter during their early voting that if they voted a straight ticket, right, for one party or another, it may have actually it was flipping some of their votes for like one or two races. People thought initially that this was some, you know, nefarious thing, but it turns out it's a bug in the system, and it's designed so poorly that they had to put out this notice that they're posting at all of the polling locations to tell people, don't press this button and then that button. You know, you have to be patient and wait. But these machines, again, third-party private companies making these machines, cutting corners and not making it easy for people to vote. I don't think this was, you know, necessarily a nefarious thing, because it is happening on both sides. If you voted straight Republican or straight Democrat, it was just a poor design decision by this third party, Hart, in the design of these machines. And it's just another thing that shows, you know, technology is not necessarily the solution to everything. People might be surprised to hear me say that, but paper ballots are, you know, they're paper. They, you know, you can't really mess them up. And we need to go back to verifiable paper ballots in many of these many cases for reasons like this.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, technology is look to with a constant sort of eye that whatever's new is better than whatever came before it, that technology has this progress curve. It's inevitable. It's invariable. It's built in. Everything is, quote, progress. But of course, there are contradictions in progress, as we can see from industrial scientific development, accessing the Earth's natural resources in a way that has allowed for cities to be built everywhere and big factories and commodities that are being utilized to help people have a better life. And yet, at the same time, the access to those resources in their own contradictoriness also could be ending the, you know, the way we know the human race is organized to live on this planet as a consequence of climate change. Paper, too, or paper ballots are also a technology. Just help explain, why not go back to the paper ballot? There's all sorts of indications. I mean, let's look at 2016. The Democrats were making the argument the Russians are hacking into our voter registrations, or hacking into state election records, blah, blah, blah. That turned out not to be true. But let's assume somebody's hacking somewhere. Why not end the hack by going back to the paper ballot? What's the reason?
Well, in this case, we have companies making so much money on technology on these, you know, third-party voting machines. There are so many, you know, many companies that provide them to states and cities and counties, and they're making a lot of money off of it. Part of it is, you know, is honestly this 24-hour news cycle where you want to get the, you know, they want to report the results as soon as possible, you know, within minutes sometimes of the polls closing. And they do use, you know, the technology from these machines to summarize and tally the results. But there's no reason that we need to have that result, you know, at 8:02 p.m. when the polls closed at 8 o'clock. It doesn't end the world if we have to wait till the next day or even the day after in order to find out the result. So I blame in part the media, but also these private companies that are clamoring to make more and more money with these, you know, subpar machines.
Yeah, so it's driven partly by media corporations, who are corporations. They want to beat out the other media corporations with news. So there's this stepped up, tempestuous dynamic desire for instant gratification, instant news, again, driven really not because people absolutely must have it right then and there, but in the past, we didn't get it right then and there. It's really driven by the same corporate profit motives that have in so many other ways distorted the idea of democracy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I completely agree.
Okay, let's go on, Chris Garofa, to our next story.
Okay, so this is actually a little bit of good news, and we have talked in the past about this case, so I thought it was important to bring an update. This is the case Lazoha v. Nielsen, Nielsen referring to Kirstjen Nielsen, the director of the Department of the Secretary of Homeland Security for the United States. This case centered around an American Muslim woman whose iPhone was taken from her at the border. She filed a lawsuit demanding not only her iPhone back, which she got back after 90 days, but also that the Department of Homeland Security delete the data they had saved from her phone. They did this under what's called Rule 41G, which is just, you know, trying to get a motion to return property. So trying to get your property back. And she has won this lawsuit. She got her iPhone back originally, but still sued to get Customs and Border Protection, which is under the purview of DHS, to get to delete the data that they had gotten. And this is such an important thing. Now, DHS seized her phone under what's called the border doctrine, right? It's this idea that within 100 miles of a U.S. border, some of your constitutional rights are actually not going to be recognized. And this is something that we've talked about with the ACLU reports. Now, I'm very happy that this judge ruled and DHS was forced to give her to not only give her her phone back, but promise to delete the data under court supervision, and so they're not going to have this backup, this copy of her phone. It's important to note in this, as reported in this article by Ars Technica, that there has been a 50% increase year over year in digital searches at the border. And that's why it's so important for people who want to keep their devices private to make sure that they use a good passcode and not just a, you know, touch ID or face ID or other biometrics, especially when they're traveling at ports or near the border.
Okay, Chris Garaffa is our guest. We talk to Chris every Monday about the big issues in technology. The issues that affect all of us, affect our lives, affect society. We speak to Chris Monday on our second segment of Loud and Clear. You can hear Loud and Clear every day, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM, 1390 AM, and at SputnikNews.com. You can also hear this segment every day live at 4:30 at SputnikNews.com, or if you're, as I said, in the Washington, D.C. area at those two stations, 105.5 FM and 1390 AM. You can also subscribe to Loud and Clear at iTunes Radio, iHeartRadio. You can see it or hear it on Spotify. You can hear it at Spreaker. You can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. Chris Garaffa, let's keep moving. What's the next story?
Well, the next story is coming from the BBC, and it says that there were 81,000 Facebook accounts that were hacked. But it wasn't because of a Facebook security flaw. It was actually because people installed browser extensions. You know, you can install little extensions in your browser to help your web browsing experience. And often these are installed when you install some other software. They're tricky. They're pretty shady. Some of these extensions were taking people, when you logged into Facebook, they were taking your messages and sending them to this really like shady website that apparently was hosted in Ukraine and St. Petersburg. And now these messages are actually for sale, 10 cents per account, by the way, but 81 million hacked accounts. Apparently these messages are for sale on the dark market, on the dark web. And this isn't something that Facebook is actually responsible for. But the publishers of these malicious browser extensions are. Again, it's an important story to realize that no security is perfect. But we need to be. People should be aware when they're installing software on their computers to look at who published it, look at the source that it came from, and look at what kind of permission it's trying to get from you. In many cases, these private Facebook conversations might have very personal information, not just bank information or credit cards necessarily. But in one example, somebody is complaining about their son-in-law. And that's not something that I'm sure that person would want out in public, right? That was a private conversation that they were having with somebody else. So that's it's very concerning that this happened. Facebook, again, we can't blame Facebook necessarily in this case, but it's important to remember whenever we're using social media, even if we think something is entirely private, if it's online, it effectively is online for all to see at some point.
Okay, just again, for our audience that may be not as tech savvy as you or I, that's a joke about me, but what's a malicious browser extension? Just go over again, what's a browser extension? And again, just help the audience understand, how do you avoid it?
Yeah, absolutely. A browser extension is something that works in your web browser, like Firefox or Internet Explorer or Safari, that sometimes can actually give you a benefit. It can block ads. It can help you download files faster, other things like that. The problem is when you install other software from the internet that you've downloaded, a lot of them will try to install these kind of shady pieces of software, the browser extensions, into your browser, right? So if you're installing a free game, for example, you might get they might try to install a browser extension that tracks what you're doing online, and then they sell that for ads, or they sell your private information. And in some cases, this software was also infected in such a way that it was actually it was looking at your private Facebook messages and sending it back to these servers in Ukraine and St. Petersburg, and now your messages are for sale. So it's always about being careful about what you're installing, and if something seems too good to be true, if it's free, be very cautious about installing anything that appears to be free that maybe shouldn't be.
And because we're talking about St. Petersburg or Ukraine in the midst of the anti-Russia sort of witch hunt, which is what I believe it is, there's going to be an impression left that this is Russia or Russians who are doing it. A lot of the victims here, in fact, are Russians and Ukrainians, right?
That's right. Most of them are actually Russian and Ukrainian. And I should note, it doesn't take much to set up a server in Russia, Ukraine, any country. Anyone who knows how to register for a web hosting service like GoDaddy or similar can actually set up a server that's in almost any country in the world within minutes. And it's not necessarily, a bad thing. People do that for a number of reasons. So it's not necessarily Ukrainians or Russians, and certainly there's no connection to the government of Russia in this case.
Okay, let's keep moving. Chris Garoff is our guest. What's our next story, Chris?
Well, there is a connection between Microsoft and the government of the U.S. in this story. So we're talking about Microsoft regularly sharing data from Indian bank customers with U.S. intelligence agencies. So the Reserve Bank of India put out a statement that it was concerned about the fact that Microsoft was sending transaction and other financial details of Indian bank companies with U.S. Intelligence agencies. So this is Microsoft, effectively a U.S.-based company that does have a presence in India that is being asked by the American government to send information about Indian citizens. And in over 3,000 cases and 2 years between 2014 and 2016, it has complied with those demands with little or no oversight by Indian courts.
Wow, that's amazing. Chris Garoffo, let's keep moving. We have so many big stories. We're talking about the big technology issues of the week, as we do every Monday in this segment. It's called Technology Rules with Chris Garoffo, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedoms, civil rights, and civil liberties. Chris, let's keep moving. What's the next story?
Well, let's go over to Belgium now. In the last week, we have confirmed that GCHQ, the British intelligence headquarters, not only hacked the Belgian telecommunications company called Belgicom, which is actually now goes by the name Proximus, but then actively tried to sabotage, they say, the investigation by the Belgian security services. Belgicom was half owned by the Belgian state, and it was hacked in 2013. Now, the reason it was such a target of the British intelligence is that it provides mobile phone services, cell phone services, to many Middle Eastern companies, because in many cases they can't get those services reliably locally or through other Western companies because of sanctions or outright war. And this is exceptional, they say, and the Belgian government actually says this is exceptional because it's between two EU states. So GCHQ hacking the Belgian federal, Belgian partly state-owned telecommunications company, and that isn't something that you actually see very often. Now, there's a lot, obviously, as we know, of turbulence in the EU right now, especially between with the Brexit leave vote that happened and everything that's happened since then. But this happened before that. And so, and of course, the GCHQ, the British government, is a partner, in many ways, a junior partner of the U.S. in spying across the world. It is one of the Five Eyes countries that spies on all internet traffic. And it provides information to the U.S. government all the time. About what it is seeing.
Who are the Five Eyes?
So the Five Eyes countries are the U.S., Australia, Canada, the U.K., and New Zealand. So all across the world, and they are at very important communications junctions regarding where cables and satellites go across the world. And this is a very old partnership, actually, dating almost back to the post-World War II period.
Chris Garaffa, let's go on to another story. This is about a bill that's been introduced in the Senate. It's a piece of draft legislation introduced by Senator Ron Wyden, Democrat from Oregon. Let's talk about what this bill says, and also, is it possible that it might pass? Go ahead.
Well, the bill is called the Consumer Data Protection Act, and you know, Ron Wyden has been one of the most vocal critics in during hearings of Facebook and Google and Twitter and many other companies. So I'm glad to see this draft come out. Unfortunately, it is only a draft, and one of the most significant things here is that executives who knowingly hide data breaches in their filings. In their government filings, could actually go to jail for up to 20 years. Now, that sounds great, right? Unfortunately, we have seen with regulations of the banking and other industries that executives rarely, if ever, get punished in any way, let alone go to jail for any amount of time. But this is the sort of bill that we actually do need to be pushing for. And this is also the sort of bill that we need to force our legislatures, our attorney generals, and the government to enforce should it pass. Now, legislation can only do so much, but people's movements are really what will cause something like this to pass and to be enforced. So I'm going to be keeping an eye on this. I imagine that as it goes through the process, the legislative process through the Senate and then through the House of Representatives, it's going to be changed. It will the trade industries will attempt to water it down. But I encourage people to keep a close eye on this. Again, it is a draft. It's available on Ron Wyden's website to read. It's called the Consumer Data Protection Act.
Chris Garaffa, next story. Pentagon wants to predict anti-Trump protests using social media surveillance. That doesn't sound good.
No, this is not good at all. We know that the that social media companies, Facebook, Twitter, Google and many others will share information with the Pentagon, with the NSA, the CIA, whoever asks for it, right? This story is about the Pentagon releasing information about some research projects and some patent filings that they've made in partnership with private companies to not just spy on individuals, but actually to use mass data points, like just collecting so much data you can't even believe how much it's getting, and use machine learning technology to try to see when there's going to be, you know, a large-scale protest, what they call the outbreak of conflict, terrorism, and civil unrest. And they're actually looking at past experiences with this. They're studying you know, the Arab Spring. They're studying social media from the Arab Spring, but they're also studying, we've since found out, social media from Baltimore with the Baltimore uprising when after Freddie Gray was killed by police there. They're studying what happened in Ferguson. And they're studying so many different locations, including actually the protests like the Women's March that happened in January right after Donald Trump was inaugurated. So they're looking at social media data. It may not be individualized data, but they're going to try to use this to actually track when and where there are going to be mass uprisings and protests and movements happening. It's a very scary use of this technology, and some of it, they're hoping, will be done in real time, and that's what some of the forward-looking proposals and projects they've put out are talking about.
30 seconds for this story, and then we want to get your technology tips. Researchers find Stuxnet, Mirai, WannaCry lurking in industrial USB drives. 30 seconds on that, and then we're going to go to your technology tip.
Okay, so Stuxnet, Mirai, WannaCry were three viruses, pieces of malware that caused billions and billions of dollars in damage. Stuxnet was actually developed by the American and Israeli governments to specifically target Iranian nuclear facilities and destroy the equipment. Now, they've been found on just these USB thumb drives all over the place now. And it shows the issue when these tools and these viruses get out in the wild, with the fact that they could be plugged into anyone's computer now and restart the infection all over again. That's why I wanted to draw attention to this.
Yeah, we thank you for that. Chris Garafa is our guest. We end this segment every Monday with a tech tip from Chris Garafa. We have about 45 seconds left. Chris, go ahead.
Okay, so I want to encourage people, when you're done with a computer or a phone, don't just throw it in the garbage. You should recycle it. Electronics recycling should hopefully be available in your city or town or county. But you want to erase everything on your computer and your phone. On a phone, you want to go to the settings and you want to erase everything. There's a reset all button or something like reset all. For a computer, you want to reboot it and delete all of your files and do that so that no one who goes into the recycling center can open up your computer and get your files, your bank information, your personal email or whatever your documents in it. There's more to this, but hopefully we can talk about that next week.
All right. And we will talk about it next week. Next Monday, Chris will join us once again. This segment is called Technology Rules with Chris Garafa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations in the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedom, civil rights, and civil liberties. You can hear it every Monday at 4:30 p.m. Eastern Time here at SputnikNews.com at 105.5 FM, 1390 AM. You can subscribe at various platforms, including iHeartRadio, iTunes Radio, and Spotify. We were joined once again by Chris Garafa, web developer and technologist. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.